stockpile by people who don't use it. They're just stockpiling that stuff. Very few of them are used. They have a very limited number of buffers in that risk force. Whereas we have them, I think, by chapters on the first. And this Robert De Cosmos on right here, Belgrade. Maybe Vasil Bankacho had to leave early. And Mathieu Fafco, who's an economist who said he would be here this afternoon.
Okay.
So maybe I could just give the floor to you and Brian. Brian is very well aware of these subjects and I might have. Enablement is sort of the here, because it can be very interesting to have this discussion here. I think you made it so you don't know, perhaps you don't know your own ideas of what a participant of the study on the economic impact of software happens, at least that is the title, which the European Commission ordered from the Intellectual Property Institute in London. So the, this is, normally it's a bit weird perhaps to think that you order an economic study from an intellectual property institute, but usually intellectual property institutes say economic study is not my field. And in fact, I think it wasn't first not an economic study, it was mainly a legal study, but then there was the Eurolinux petition which said we have to have an economic study, that's why the petition in June that came up, he said the EU must have an economic study before it decides on the directive. And then this study was suddenly renamed an economic study. And a chapter was added, it's a rather short chapter on economics, and this was written by Peter Holmes. He's the economist of the study, which is mainly written by Adam Boyers, but has this additional economics chapter. And the economics chapter has one statement that is cited by everybody ever since.
It's not actually the economic chapter.
It's not the economic chapter.
Only the summary.
No, but there is one.
One of the funny things.
One of the funny things about the study is the economics chapter says, I think it says or is that only in summary too?
This is what I put up on the screen.
Okay.
So you know it already deserves a chance to respond.
Well, you know it already. But the study at least says there's one advantage of software patents, which is that they have helped in the U.S. to make small companies grow into sizable, indeed major companies. And there are three disadvantages, and these are, what best invests in this thing, is that they're not good for, arguably not good for innovation, that they may create legal insecurity and monopoly effects. That's again what the objective summary says. The three disadvantages are just a question of running the patent system right, and the main advantages of court. The advantages to the court, and this the advantage of allowing medium, small and medium sized companies to grow into big companies. It's not in that study, there's no evidence presented for it. It just says there is overwhelming evidence for this, but the study does not list any of the evidence. And, but that was, I think you probably said that too. And I think there's.
Peter's speech. But if you would introduce the other panelists.
Yeah, the other panelists. But I think you would maybe not exactly talk about the study, but that
was
very interesting.
Well, I would like to talk.
Very good.
Yeah.
And then, abuses that the large
just sort of came up with about this particular quotation and context. As I say, this is a study was done by myself and by these two patent lawyers. The summary was described both once by Richard Wright and the patent lawyers, who genuinely believed on the basis of their personal experience that the proposition which they quoted was true, and believed that they had strong, and I think you named it anecdotal evidence that patents had been with small software companies. That statement was then qualified by all the other disadvantages, I think there has been a problem that, based on the American literature, it's a bit difficult to demonstrate that how many of the disadvantages come from the bad patents as such, and how much comes from the business methods patents. And so I think I would still agree with what Lars Lessig said yesterday, that as of about a couple of years ago, you really couldn't argue that the economic evidence was overwhelming that introducing software patents and applying the system properly with a proper technical benefit to technical contribution test and excluding business methods, if you could do all of that, as the evidence stood a couple of years ago, you couldn't make a very, very overwhelming case that this would necessarily be a bad thing. What I did manage to get into the report, and which is quoted by the Commission but not the the Parliament, was that to any move to strengthen intellectual property protection in the software industry cannot claim to rest on solid economic evidence. That statement is in the report, and I'll stand by that as the one thing which I think can be agreed universally, that could be agreed 2 years ago. I think that the recent work of Bessel and Hunt clearly takes one even further than that. So I just wanted, as I say, explain that the background of that study it was written by a committee of which I was one member of three, as well as two patent lawyers. I do think actually that despite the fact that it was much less critical of the American system than most people here would like, it actually did have an impact in getting the Commission to rethink its very enthusiastic position of 2 or 3 years ago. They actually wanted to go all the way along to the American position. A couple of years ago, the Commission was saying, well, we really ought to be harmonizing to the American position. They being antagonistic to intellectual property law. Historically, competition law was a community issue and intellectual property law was more of a national domain. And competition law has been used over the years as a way of preventing intellectual property holders from segmenting, using their intellectual property rights to segment the European market. So there's been a long jurisprudence of the competition authorities attacking the abuses of intellectual property rights, not the issuing of them, because that wasn't in conflict. The directive is just bringing the community into that area. As somebody said, it may be a good thing that the community, rather than just the EPO, is dealing with these things. But of course, it does give the community then a vested interest in the recording of these rights. But we still have the competition authorities acting against, and it seems to me that one proper line of challenge, both sort of high policy level and individual sort of firms and activists, is to actually file competition complaints. There are quite a number of jurisdictions in the community where the competition authority is obliged to investigate any complaint if reasonable. The commission itself is not obliged. The commission can reject complaints. But there are a number of jurisdictions where, for example, in Britain, if you go through the Consumers Association, they take that up, then the Office of Fair Trading is obliged to investigate. And I'm at present discussing with the Consumers Association complaints that we can file against the enforcement of regional coding on DVDs and against licensing terms that Microsoft imposes on universities, both of which are actually copyright rather than the patent as far as I'm concerned. So I would given that explanation, just like to end by saying I think that, and the report actually does say this, that if we are going in the direction of further enhancing of intellectual property rights, if we have done it, then it's imperative that collectively we think how these rights, some of which have been given, and some of which we're never going to be able to take back, even if you roll back some of the legislative proposals, how the abuse of these rights can be constrained by competition law. So
let me ask a question in direct response to this issue, the effectiveness of competition law in constraining abuses of that from what you've seen as abuse. Because it seems to me there's nothing in competition law that answers the problem that we focused on during the hearing this morning and the concern that most of the people have here, that somebody, whether it's a large company or a small company, and in many cases, in most cases in the U.S., that small companies are starting to see big companies get extremely aggressive in a way we haven't seen before. But basically, nothing prevents the kind of holdup or broadcast threatening that is a major concern.
Well, is it in principle? It could be a threat. It should be a threat by these companies.
We don't have that in the U.S.
Well, in Europe, we do.
Yeah, I
have some information on that.
Speak loudly.
Yeah. So, first of all, about abuse of dominance, what's being done currently on the Microsoft case does not give at all an impression that there is any use for a small company to use competition law, because the delay is simply too long. Just in practice, certain things in the area of anti-competitive practices. So the current situation is rather reversed from what you suggest.
And small and medium enterprises. When I read the program, research shows that small and medium enterprises are skeptical about car user patterns. How do the numbers play? I would maybe stop the second sentence here. How do the numbers play? And just try to ask myself not about a qualitative approach of patterns, but about a quantitative approach of patterns, and to what end would that serve precisely? And seeing that, I would just raise one question: indicators, especially in economics, which for some of them, when you try to characterize innovation in itself, when you try to approach innovation, trying to characterize either a sectorial, a regional, or a national innovation system, the patterns, patterns in themselves can be used are actually one of the easiest tools to use when you're trying to quantify, to get in touch with innovation as itself. Because it's something which is codified, which is there, which you can go through. I mean, a library that is virtually already done for you to digest and to use as a tool however you want. But so if you're trying to study, for example, links and linkage, I know that because I have a friend working on that, between university and firms, for example, trying to see cross-pattern citations or scientific publication citations and patterns to try to see what kind of linkage you can see between universities and firms, you'll have an approach which is a very quantitative approach behind of the patterns in themselves. And in that way, I just wanted to make a remark that, first of all, patterns are in these kind of approaches treated all the same, all the same way. And these kind of comparisons, first of all, forget, of course, many qualitative questions, which are, well, first of all, from an international basis, considering proper, if we could find any proper patterns, but at least patterns that answer to the original assignations, which were new industrial applications plus non-obvious stuff that can be patented. And if we follow that very precise definition based on tangible goods in mind, the propension to patent is radically different between countries, which means that the cultural approach to patent is radically different, and which means too that for software patents, for example, there will be a time needed for European firms. Of course, the subject in itself is already there, but a time will be needed for the culture to evolve. What is already accepted in the United States as a standard approach, because you need to protect your assets, will take some time too in Europe to come up, because it is not the same. And so the validation of software patents in a way can lead to a quantitative explosion that can have too some positive effects, kind of, in policy comparisons about innovations, and which can be a reason why you can find too some policy support in allowing as many different industrial sectors to patent their innovations on themselves. A few points about what has been said. I can tell you that actually it is true that there are some inventions, some software inventions, some algorithms that are difficult to find. I mean, if you are developing software, you know, the kind of very complex structure that allows you to do
directive under the, this kind of directive that is kind of part of the these new people, these responsible people that maybe works against the interest of the public property. Okay, the public property that has just shown us clearly is to grant up. Under the new rules, and these people will have to shut up and say, okay, the rules have changed. And we have to have everything that we can check about the real output values. Let me get back to another point that is important for me. In another meeting discussing about these issues with people from the legal perspective, they said, actually, look at our business. Look at us lawyers. We have to deal with intellectual property. We have two ways of protecting intellectual property. One is copyright. The other is patent. They are pretty different, of course, because copyright does not allow you to prevent somebody else from using the same idea, implementing it in another way, and produce another form. While patents allow you to deny the application of the same idea, and this is the central point, not how much money you get out of it, but that we are fighting against the schema that allows somebody to just prevent the rest of the world from applying an idea that can be naive, that can be seen under the different. And so they say, you see, from my point of view, that of a lawyer, it is much easier to go to court with a patent case against the copyright case. Why? Because if somebody here, for example, John Paul, steals a piece of my code, use it to give a new application, I kind of know this, and I
is, yes, straightforward infringement is often easy to answer, but that's not where the action is. The action is on invalidity and invalidating claims, and that can involve huge searches for prior art, and also the stakes are often so much greater in a patent case. Look, for instance, at Kodak and Polaroid case, where it's a whole industry, really, that is being challenged, or the case I'm involved in now, Akamai and the Digital Island. It's really a whole, the whole future of a company depends on whether a patent can hold or not. So people are willing to spend huge amounts on patent cases. I mean, it's not unusual to see both sides spending $5 to $10 million on litigation, because so much is at stake. And when it gets to invalidity, there's no limit to the amount of discovery and work that can be done. That's why it's so.
it's not relative.